When I was a kid, I used to get lots of hand-me-down clothes from my cousins and family friends. Does anyone here still get hand-me-downs? Are you now all too big? Yeah, you're not too big yet. Yeah. Now, I'm a parent now, so I love receiving the hand-me-downs to give to my kids. But back then, when I was a kid, I was not a fan of hand-me-down clothes. I wanted the new stuff, none of this second-hand rubbish. And so it surprised me that once when I was chained to one of my cousins, she complained that she never got handed down clothes. She thought she was like, she was really hard done by because she only ever got given new clothes. Allegedly, this is what she told me, that she wanted the comforting softness that comes from clothes that have been loved and worn by someone else. I thought she was crazy. But there were other hand-me-downs that, as a kid, I did love. I had an uncle who was into technology, and so whenever he upgraded his computer, we got the old one. And that's fantastic. That's the kind of hand-me-down that I was into, and I'm still into that kind of hand-me-down. It's probably why I've got too many computers sitting around our house today. Families have lots of hand-me-downs. You might have your grandmother's heirloom brooch or her engagement ring. We hand down stories, don't we, throughout the generation of something that great-grandfather once did. Maybe your red hair or your lack of hair. Actually, tonight that qualifies just one person for both of them, doesn't it? Anyway, maybe that's come down through your family. Maybe you've got mannerisms that have come down through your family. The question for tonight is, do we hand down knowing God? Is the gospel a hand-me-down for your family? Are you handing down the hope that we have in Jesus? The psalm that we're hearing tonight is a challenge and a warning. It's a challenge to keep handing down the gospel of God, and it's a warning about what happens when it's not handed down. So have your Bibles open there to Psalm 78. And if you have a look at the beginning of the psalm, we see that it's linked to a guy called Asaph. Before verse 1 starts, we've got a little heading there, which is an ancient heading. It's part of the Hebrew Bible. It's not put in, just in the 70s by the NIV translators. And this heading says that this psalm is a maskil, which is some kind of poem or song of Asaph. Now, who's Asaph? There's a few blokes in the Old Testament called Asaph, but most likely the one here is the one who is a temple musician recruited by King David. So in 1 Chronicles 6, it says, "These are the men David put in charge of the music in the house of the Lord after the ark came to rest there." And then, because we're in 1 Chronicles, there's a long list of names, and eventually you get down to Heman's associate Asaph, who served at his right hand, and then the list keeps on going. So this is probably the guy. This is probably the Asaph. Now, when it says it's a maskil of Asaph, that could mean that Asaph wrote it. It could mean that this was one of his favorites. This is one when he got out his lyre, he rocked out to Psalm 78. This is one of Asaph's favorites. Or maybe it was actually written after the time of Asaph in his honor. We don't know. But by saying this is a psalm of Asaph, as we look at it, what comes straight to our mind is that time when David was king in Israel, when a man after God's own heart was on the throne. So keep that in mind as we look into the psalm, and as we get particularly towards the end, you'll see why that's significant. Now, this psalm begins by telling us that we need to listen up. We need to listen up because this psalm tells us a parable, a story. It tells us Israel's story, which is a sad story of rebellion and faithlessness. And it tells us this story, not just because it likes telling stories about old dead guys, but for our benefit and also for the benefit of the future. This psalm looks to the past for the sake of the future. So listen up, verse 1. Psalm 78 and verse 1. "My people, hear my teaching. Listen to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth with a parable. I will utter hidden things, things from of old, things we have heard and known, things our ancestors have told us. We will not hide them from their descendants. We will tell the next generation the praiseworthy deeds of the Lord, his power and the wonders he has done." You get the vibe there in verses 3 and 4. Our grandparents told us about what God has done. It's our job to pass it on. Why is that? Why is it our job to pass it on? Well, because if it's not passed on, it's gone. On Anzac Day and Remembrance Day, what's the slogan? Lest we forget. Lest we forget. humans are forgetful. And it's not just the where are my keys forgetfulness, but we forget the past. We forget the stories, the sacrifice, the horrors, lest we forget. Israel was at risk of forgetting. Forgetting what God had done for them, forgetting what God had asked for them, forgetting the lessons that their ancestors had been taught. And so this psalm says, listen up to what I'm about to say, remember and pass it down. So verse 5 tells us what God has done. He decreed statutes for Jacob and established the law in Israel, which he commanded our ancestors to teach their children so the next generation would know them, even the children yet to be born, and they in turn would tell their children. Then they would put their trust in God and they would not forget his deeds, but would keep his commands. They would not be like their ancestors, a stubborn and rebellious generation whose hearts were not loyal to God, whose spirits were not faithful to him. Adults have a great responsibility to teach children. Kids don't come with a built-in look both ways before you cross the road, knives are sharp, irons are hot. They just don't know these things. They need to be taught them. And they need to be taught the things of God, what it means to trust God, what it means to know what he's done, how to follow God's ways. It's not something that's built in when we're born. It's something that's handed down. But God's people didn't do this. The history of Israel is a story of people who didn't do this. They didn't hand it down. And so then the opposite of what verse 7 says happens. The next generation don't know what God has done in the past, and so they forget him, they ignore his commands, and they don't trust him. And so Israel's history is this tragic story of what happens when you don't hand it down. And it's not only a single sad story, it's a sad story of what happens over and over again. It's a cycle. The people forget God and then they rebel against him and so God punishes them. But out of his love, he shows mercy. If you jump down to verse 35, you can see sort of elements of this cycle starting at verse 35. The people, they remembered that God was their rock, that God Most High was their Redeemer, but then they would flatter him with their mouths, lying to him with their tongues. Their hearts were not loyal to him. They were not faithful to his covenant, yet he was merciful. So this one skips out the punishment. He forgave their iniquities and did not destroy them. Time after time, he restrained his anger and did not stir up his full wrath. He remembered that they were but flesh, a passing breeze that does not return. But the story keeps going on. The cycle keeps continuing, an endless cycle. And that's what the bulk of this psalm does. It tells this sad history of what happens when you don't pass it on. It is a long psalm. It goes for 72 verses, and 64 of them just tell the same story over and over again. There's different people, they're in different places, but the story's the same. The cycle keeps repeating. It is a long read, this psalm, and it's maddening. As you read it, it just keeps going on and on. You want it to stop. You want to tear out your hair at the foolishness of these people. There's a saying, isn't there? There's a saying that a fool learns from his own mistakes. A wise man learns from the mistakes of others. These guys, they don't learn from the mistakes that others have made. And as you read through, you actually realize that some of them don't even learn from their own mistakes. So I don't know what do you say for a person that's not even a fool? Like, they're not even smart enough to be a fool. I mean, this is really, really sad, isn't it? It's a long psalm. Sadly, we don't have time to read it all tonight. So hopefully, as we skim over at the tops and sort of dip in at a few places, it'll help you to unpack it and read it yourself and sort of get the real weight of this psalm. That's what we lose from not reading the whole psalm is the weight of the cycle repeating over and over again. But you can now do that yourself during the week. So what we're going to do is we're going to have a look at basically the first time around the cycle and then mainly skim through until we get to the end. So back to verse 9 in the Psalms, so Psalm 78, verse 9, it starts off talking about these men of Ephraim. Who are they? Who are the men of Ephraim? Well, to understand who they are, we need a quick recap of Israel's history. After David was king, you know, David and Goliath, after he becomes king, his son Solomon was made king. And you've got a map up there of the region that they controlled. So the shaded region was the area that Solomon controlled when he was king. And when Solomon died, there was a coup, and the nation was divided into two. Solomon's son, so the guy who should have become king, his name is Rehoboam, and he maintains control of the southern region. So that's the purple bit. That's the tribes of Judah and Benjamin. But the northern tribes follow a bloke called Jeroboam. It's a bit confusing. It's Rehoboam in the south. He's Solomon's son. Jeroboam is the guy in the north. He had been an advisor to Solomon, and he was of the tribe of Ephraim. He was an Ephraimite. And so this psalm, as it talks about these men of Ephraim, our vision, our minds are taken to that top group of people in Israel, the northern kingdom, a kingdom that basically from their beginning turned their back on God. So verse 9, the men of Ephraim, though armed with bows, turned back on the day of battle. They did not keep God's covenant and refused to live by his law. They forgot what he had done, the wonders he had shown them. And what are the wonders that God had shown them that they'd forgotten? Well, think about the Exodus. Moses walking through the Red Sea. God made water gush out of a rock, providing food, manna from heaven and quail too. The men of Ephraim should have remembered that stuff, the stuff that God had done way back then. They should have handed down this history of God's grace and power to their children, but they didn't. So if you look at verse 15, this is what Ephraim should have remembered. So we're picking it up, the story of Israel with the people. This is the generation that were brought out of Egypt. So pick it up. Verse 15, God split the rocks in the wilderness and gave them water as abundant as the seas. He brought streams out of a rocky crag and made water flow down like rivers. But they continued to sin against him, rebelling in the wilderness against the Most High. They willfully put God to the test by demanding the food they craved. They spoke against God. They said, can God really spread a table in the wilderness? True, he struck the rock and water gushed out. Streams flowed abundantly. But can he also give us bread? Can he supply meat for his people? When the Lord heard them, he was furious. His fire broke out against Jacob and his wrath rose against Israel, for they did not believe in God or trust in his deliverance. Yet he gave a command to the skies above and opened the doors of the heavens. He rained down manna for the people to eat. He gave them the grain of heaven. You can almost laugh at this situation, can't you? The foolishness of these people. Look, God miraculously gave us water out of a rock, but can he give us food? Maybe he can't. You'd almost laugh if this wasn't so serious. And if you also just didn't see a little bit of yourself in them. Well, the psalm keeps going round and round the cycle. When you get to verse 54, so we're skipping all the way to verse 54, finally these people, the people of Israel, they are finally ready to enter the land of Canaan after going through all the stuff in the wilderness, and God brings them into the land. He gives them the land, but nothing changes. The cycle continues. Verse 56, but they put God to the test and rebelled against the Most High. This is the people in the land. They did not keep his statutes. Like their ancestors, they were disloyal and faithless, as unreliable as a faulty bow. It's a great picture, isn't it? The picture of a faulty bow. I'm not much of an archer, but you get the picture. You know, twang, twang. Like, I would blame the archer, but it's the faulty bow in this picture, isn't it? It's useless. That's what God's people were like. You think they're going in the right direction, straight away off they go. Either no one handed it down to them, no one passed on the message of God's grace, or they deliberately ignored and didn't learn from what happened before them. And so the cycle, it just keeps on going. And finally, we get to the time of David in verse 65. So we've skipped over a lot of detail. It's worth reading, but we just don't have time tonight. Verse 65, we get to the high point of Israel's history, the time when a man after God's own heart was king over Israel, a man who God chose. And although he had his faults, we looked at Samuel pretty recently, didn't we? We're well aware of Samuel's faults. He was a good and godly king. So verse 65, then the Lord awoke as from sleep, as a warrior wakes from the stupor of wine. He beat back his enemies. He put them to everlasting shame. Then he rejected the tents of Joseph. He did not choose the tribe of Ephraim. Here's Ephraim again. But he chose the tribe of Judah, Mount Zion, which he loved. He built his sanctuary like the heights, like the earth that he established forever. He chose David, his servant, and took him from the sheep pens. From tending the sheep, he brought him to be the shepherd of his people, Jacob, of Israel, his inheritance. And David shepherded them with integrity of heart. With skillful hands, he led them. It's a pretty strange way to end this psalm, isn't it? If I'd written this psalm, look, it would have had a pretty dud tune, but that's not how I would have finished it. I'd finish it by repeating it, what I said at the beginning. So I'd say something like, therefore, don't be so stupid. Look, God has given you this king. It's your chance to learn from your mistakes. Tell your kids, learn, don't repeat those mistakes. Learn, you've got David as king. This is our chance. But that's not what this psalm does. Because God's a better songwriter than I am. It just stops. It leaves it hanging. Dot, dot, dot. What are you going to do? How are you going to write the end of this psalm? Because whenever this psalm was written, it may not have been long after the time of David and Solomon. And by leaving it hanging, it says, look, the story of Israel, it isn't finished. How are you going to finish it? Especially now that God has chosen you and given you this temple, that the solid sanctuary, the solid building that shows that his presence is with you, and he's given you King David, and you're now living in his wake. This is a time of so much promise. But sadly, we know how this psalm was written by the people as the history continued. Israel, they didn't learn from their mistakes. God's people didn't make the good news of God a hand-me-down so that their kids would learn from the mistakes of others. That didn't happen. And so for hundreds of years, you can imagine this psalm being sung in the temple or in people's homes. And as they sing it, they'd be hanging their head. They'd be going, oh, when on earth are we going to learn? When are we going to learn? And the psalm remained unfinished and the cycle kept going. Where we fit into this psalm is we're not part of the nation of Israel. This psalm is not our song by birth. But Jesus is the king God promised to Israel, the son of David who came to put an end to this endless cycle. And those who call Jesus king and who trust in him, we're brought into his kingdom. And so the story of God's people, Israel, it becomes our story. Not by birth, but by adoption, by ingrafting. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, we're told that even though we are not Jews or Israelites, we're not the people this psalm was written about originally, it's the same God. It's the same God. And the things that happened to them, the things we read in Psalm 78, they're written as an example to us. Our job is to be wise and to learn from their mistakes. And it's pretty obvious what we're to learn, isn't it? We're to listen up and we're to hand it down. So first of all, listen up. In Psalm 78, it keeps going back to God bringing his people out of Egypt through the wilderness and into the land of Canaan. That's a story it just keeps going back to. Gets to David, goes, remember what God was like there. He just keeps remembering. That's what God has done. That's the story, the amazing story of what God had done. But as incredible as that was, it pales in the light of Jesus. The dot, dot, dot for us in 2015 is, and Jesus came. God's great king has come, and this king, the amazing thing that God did in and through him, it happened on the cross. Even if Jesus died on a cross, he was executed, and 3 days later he rose from the dead. When Jesus died, it wasn't because of his failure. He died for us so that we can be forgiven. Forgiven even if we are as foolish as Israel was over and over again, even if that cycle has been our cycle, even if we've heard the good news of God thousands of times over and over again and we've ignored it, Jesus died so that we can be forgiven and brought into God's kingdom. Listen up. Don't be like Israel who refused God's mercy, who refused to remember God and just chucked his mercy back in his face. Listen up. Remember God, trust in Jesus. That's the first thing this psalm is saying to us. That's how we need to be writing the end of this psalm tonight. The second way is, if you have handed it down yourself, sorry, if you have listened for yourself, then it's our job to hand it down. Hand the gospel down to the next generation so that they can know what God has done in Jesus. It's said that Christianity is only one generation away from extinction. It's a hand-me-down that's worth handing down. So let's get practical. How do we hand it down? Now, we don't see them here tonight because they're on their way to bed, but in our Kenmore Prezi family, there are bucket loads of kids. And the kids who are here at KPC, they are our kids. This is the family of God, and so these kids are our kids, even though they're not your kids. They're our kids. So some ideas on how we can be handing down the gospel to our kids. Please pray for the kids and the families here at church. Pray that the kids will hear the great things that God has done and that they'll trust in Jesus. Pray that they'll never know a time that they haven't called Jesus Lord. Get to know the kids at church. Show an interest in them. Join the KPC Kids team. And I know that I'm preaching to the choir here, to many people here, which is great. The KPC Kids, it's a substantial task to be part of KPC Kids. It requires preparation. And for some people, the idea of being in a room with a bunch of kids is utterly terrifying. But most of them are fairly nice. Some of them, though. But if we don't, these are our kids. If we don't, who else is going to pass it down? I think one of the great things about church is that for our KPC kids in the morning, we've got a mix of both parents and non-parents who are teaching the kids. And that's a way of showing that we realize that they are our kids. This is, we're all in this together. I've lost the slide, haven't I? That's what I need to do. It shows that we know that we are all in this together with them. We know that. So, big thanks for you guys who teach KPC Kids. Tom, Jay, Ash, John, thank you so much for being part of that. And for the guys who are part of leading youth groups, that's actually much of the same people as well. That's fantastic. This is an essential key ministry of what we're doing here at church. We're passing down the good news of Jesus so that the next generation can hear the good news and have every opportunity to trust in Jesus and follow him. Teaching RI in our local schools, I reckon that also comes in under the banner of our kids. It's a bit of a broader definition of the word ours, but the way that the RI legislation is worked out is that kids whose parents write on their enrollment form on their way into school that they're part of a Christian denomination, if they enroll their kids that way, then if there's a teacher in their school, RE teachers are there, then they're going to be taught the great things of God. Now, there's a fair bit of discussion happening at the moment about the place of RE in state schools, but I reckon our part of the job is to continue to put in good quality, well-trained Christians to put up their hands to teach and do the RE in our schools. And odds are, if that happens, RE will continue in this state for a fair while. So that's some ideas about our kids. I'm now going to talk about your kids, even though, unless some of you have been hiding something, not many of you have kids. But I reckon you need to hear this now because it may be practical one day in the future. And some of you may, sooner than that, become aunties or uncles, and so be worth thinking about that. So this is something, I'm going to talk about it, even though it's not today's practicality. Read the Bible with your kids, for little kids. And these ideas, look, they're not guarantees that your kids become Christians, but this is our part, isn't it? The Psalm tells us to pass it down. This is our part. So read the Bible with your kids. For littler kids, this is what we used to use, the big picture Bible or the Jesus storybook Bible. If you've got a niece or a nephew and they just get born, buy them one of these. These are great books because they're not just nice Bible stories. You pick up some kids' Bibles and holy dooly, it's hard to hold down your lunch. Like they're lovely and nice, but they've got very little to say about Jesus. But these two in particular, and there's been a new one released in the last few weeks by Kevin DeYoung, they do what Psalm 78 does. They put the story together into a big story that's all about Jesus. In fact, I've heard stories of adults becoming Christians because someone gave them the big picture storybook Bible. I started reading it with their kids and they finally understood actually how Moses actually is not about Moses but is about Jesus. It's great stuff. We now use these things. They're called the table talk books with our kids. probably not relevant for many people here, but we enjoy, look, it's a challenge reading your Bible with the kids. We read the Bible just before the kids go to bed, which means they're not hungry anymore, except if they've decided not to eat dinner, but they are tired. And so it is one part read the Bible, two parts pull the kids off each other, and then have a really random conversation about, you know, a stick that broke at lunch. But then you get back to it, and it's worth it, isn't it, though? It's worth it because we're passing on the good news of Jesus and showing that the Bible is how we know God and that reading the Bible is important. But being a Christian isn't just something that happens for 5 minutes before bed. Our life is shaped by following Jesus. And so there's always opportunities to talk about God, talking about thankfulness and forgiveness and what it means for God to be the creator. As we interact with kids asking for forgiveness, talking about how to live as followers of Jesus, there's lots to be done there. And we can be praying for the families and the parents at morning church that they'll be doing that. It's modeling it too. You can't teach the Christian life in a classroom kind of way. It's got to be lived and modeled. What we do speaks louder than the words we say, but we've got to say it as well, don't we? We've got to actually pass on content of the gospel. For you guys, if your nieces or nephews around the place and you want to be passing on the gospel to them, if their parents are Christians, well, then there's lots of ways you can be part of handing it down, isn't it? But if their parents aren't, I think there are still ways. You've got to be respectful of the parents, but we can still talk to them about what it means for us to be a Christian as we relate to them. We can add things, you know, think about what we can include if you write birthday cards or write letters. It's, you know, I'm sure kids like emails, but kids actually really like letters. I've discovered that my four-year-old loves receiving letters from his grandparents. So you could write letters to your nieces and nephews or invite them to be part of our kids club at the end of the year or other things we're doing at church. In our families, there are always things that we're passing on and handing down, clothes, old technology. The question that this psalm raises is, are we handing down the good news of God, so that the next generation has every opportunity to trust God and follow Jesus? So let's pray.